Hi, everybody. I am Marty. I'm an alcoholic. I had my last drink of alcohol on February the 8th of 1976 because of a loving God and a loving sponsor and an idiot that wouldn't leave me alone. Jackie was reading those traditions. I was reminded of a meeting I was at a world conference in Montreal. Some of you might have been there. Montreal, you know, people that can be rude without meaning to, you know. But anyway, outside issue. I love the French. I'm being facetious. But this woman read the traditions, and she said that for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he might express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but twisted servants. They do not govern. I've always thought from her mouth to God. It's great to be here. I was Joe and everybody that was involved in getting me here. I thank you. I probably should thank Stan M. and that crazy John voice. Because what really happened was that I was at that Lake Mead retreat. And as a special favor to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've stopped speaking. And at the retreat, they said, you know, you might want to talk at that tri-state. And I said, I'm not talking a lot. I mean, besides, I've been there and, you know, anyway. Several weeks or months later, I don't know when, I got a poster at home, tri-state poster. And I thought, all right, maybe I'll go. And I looked, and I was the Saturday night speaker. So it's all good. If you're visiting us here tonight, some of what I'm going to say may sound absolutely crazy to you, just insane. And that's probably good. If you're visiting here tonight and some of what I say to you makes a lot of sense, and you are seriously amazed because someone's talking about things you know, welcome. You. Either way, you know, whether you're visiting or you're a new drunk or you've been here for a long, long time, I hope that you'll keep an open mind. I am not an AA speaker. I don't represent Alcoholics Anonymous. I can only talk for me about me, my very favorite subjects. And in fact, some of you may want to get my new book I'm writing. It's called I'm Not Much, But I'm All I Think About. And but Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't have any professionals. It doesn't have anybody that speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. Can you imagine some of the egos around here if we were actually in charge of anything? Oh. I mean, so I'm just one kind of one voice in Alcoholics Anonymous, and so if you're new, some of it's kind of hard to get your arms around in the early going. And I always tell people it's like this. Say, for example, that there's an assembly line in another dimension where they make people. This thing's got a failure rate of somewhere between 6 and 10% in terms of creating people that can drink. And I imagine that when they were making me, that the guy that was making me must have been distracted or something. You know, sitting there, I'm a Canadian. I'm sure he thought, you know, I'll make a Canadian. Let me see what first thing I'll do. I'll get some hair. Ah, crap. We're out of hair. So Bob, have you got any of that stuff that I can put in this guy that you know, it's on for the first half, and then it goes in the ears and down his back. It's let's do that then, because he's Canadian. He's going to be cold anyway. He'll appreciate the fur later on. And so on that assembly line, you might hear hair installed. And then he starts looking around for a brain for me and says, "You know, like, is this the biggest one we've got?" All right, I'll put it in. Next stage is, of course, he's got to put in the ego. And this is where the distracted part starts. says to one of his coworkers on the assembly line, "Did you see the game last night? Oh, man, a disaster, the third quarter, just a disaster." Ego installed. "Yeah, the way we're playing, it was just, it sucked." Ego installed. Where was I? Did I put that ego in there? Maybe I'll put in a little more. It won't hurt him. Ego installed. And then he starts looking around for the sex drives because they're not where they're supposed to be. And wow, this one's huge. It's got to be at least three times what this little fella is going to need. But anyway, sex drive installed. Sex drive installed. Damn, I'm all thumbs today. Let me see, what's next here? Oh yeah, okay. Now we're going to get into the survival stuff here. Long-term memory installed. Short-term memory installed. Reflexes installed. Fear installed. Fear installed. Fear installed. Fear installed. Fear installed. Bob! This damn button stuck again. What? Okay, I'll try it. Fear installed. Fear installed. Fear. 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 No, that doesn't work, but screw it. I'm done with this one anyway. You know, it's like... So... I've got too much of some stuff and not enough of the rest, and that's what we have in common. I think the five words... Old Wino Joe used to say that the five words of Alcoholics Anonymous that are so true all the time are, "I know how you feel." Man, that's sweet when you come in. And nobody knew how I felt for a long, long time. Nobody touched me. But anyway, I'm just saying. So at 11 years old, I had a lot of fear. I was horny. And I didn't even know that was a defect of character until about 2 years ago. And so I was 11 years old when I had my first drink. Just as an aside, I went to the specific group Thursday night. There was a young woman there, and she said that she started drinking at 3 years old. 3 years old. And I thought, damn, you can't even be weird drinking at 11 anymore. Somebody can go under you, you know? It's getting more difficult to be weird in Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember one time Bob Bazan said that if you went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and you told somebody that you made love to a zebra, somebody at the meeting would say, "Well, yeah, fine for you, but I did too, but at least the one you had was a female." You know, it's always just, that's Bob said that. That Bob. Anyway, so I was 11 years old and I started drinking. I'm going to, again, just for the sake of trying to follow some sort of a format and not waste your time tonight, God, nothing would make me happier than if I said one thing tonight that was of any value to you at all. Believe me, I'm here to serve you. I really would love for this to do that. So what our program suggests is that I tell you what it was like. I'm sorry, that's not right. Check that. What I was like. It does not matter what it was like. What I was like, and then what happened, and now what I'm like. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to highlight three little stories out of my drinking experience, and trust me when I tell you this, there were many to select from. I just want to tell you, because these are kind of like the nature of the insanity and some of the characteristics of what drinking's all about when you're an alcoholic. Not a heavy drinker, you know, not a Al-Anon with an attitude. I'm talking about an alcoholic. Yeah. Just checking to see if you're here. And, I I heard an Ellen on the other day said that that he had been in the program now, and it had been 15 years since he had the need to kill anybody. You know, and I thought, alcohol does strange things. I had I'm 15, maybe 16 years old at this point. We're out in the car, we're drinking. Somebody has just mentioned that they got in a fight with and beat up their father. I thought, you got to be insane. My dad was the toughest guy in my hometown. He was like 6'3", made out of wire. He was Irish, and he did not understand pain or fear. So I thought, you're nuts. Well, two beer later, I'm thinking, you know, if I hit him, like if I went in and hit him before he got fully standing up, I'd knock him down, then I'm on him, bam, 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 and, you know, and it became more important, more drinks I had. I need to go and do this. It's some sort of a rite of passage or something. And so I had about, you know, four or five more drinks, and I said to the guys, you know, I need to get home. I got to get something. And so they said, all right. So we went, and my dad was sitting, as I knew he would be, in his big rocker chair Friday night. My brother Paul is laying on the Chesterfield beside him. And I go to my old man, and I say, get up! I'm 6 feet tall, 161 pounds. You know, they used me for getting footballs out of the sewer. I was so skinny. He said, excuse me? I said, get up! Up. And he's looking at Paul like, ooh. So he gets up, and I took a swing at him. He went, ooh. Oh. Like, here's another thing you'll never hear in an Elon meeting. It's about the keen mind of an alcoholic. It's, as I was going down the first time, every gear was clicking. I was analyzing information. I was thinking, man, you know those fights on TV, those boxers and that, when they get hit in their knees? That's real. I mean, and down I went, and I got up, and down I went, and finally he said, look, Martz, I mean, you know, stop. And I took one, and I connected a little one. And then Daddy put me down. He did. Wow. Like this. I've still got to, if you, you know, after you want to come up and see it, I've still got to. My brother Paul leaned forward and he said, stay down. So, if you roll the clock farther now, I'm probably in my early 20s. I was a radio broadcaster, a television radio broadcaster as a young guy, just about 9 or 10 years of that. And I was, you know, notorious alcoholic, drunk in the public. I remember going on the 11 o'clock news with a fire extinguisher and soaking down the news announcer live, you know, good evening. You know. And some thought I was funny. The Canadian Radio Television Commission thought I was not funny. And anyway, so I had the sweetest radio job anybody could possibly hope for. It's called The Drive Show. And I think what they were doing at the radio station was trying to contain the damage. I was funny on the radio, and I had a fairly good following, but I was a problem. And so what they did was they gave me 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, and the drive slot, which is like 3 in the afternoon until 6. And I could not, for the life of me, get to work on time. I can't even explain that. I don't know what the hell I was doing. But, you know, you're driving into work, and the guy's saying, oh, yeah, well, we'll have the Marty Jeffrey, what time will he wander in contest again today. It's about 6 o'clock, and the phone rings, and it is the marketing manager for a big brewery in Canada called Labatt's. Mm-hmm. Everybody always tries to describe what it's like to have a drink. And, you know, some people say it's like swallowing an umbrella and it opens, you know. For me, like when you did that, what I heard in my head was, you know. That's what it felt like. This guy said, you know, we haven't seen you guys from the radio station over here for a little while. Would you like to drop by after work, bring a couple of the other guys and have a beer? And I'm thinking, well, see, this is another teen alcoholic mind moment, because I was in a lot of trouble. I'd been fairly loaded a couple of days before and had sworn to God that I would never drink again. So I'm in a bit of a dilemma, but I'm thinking, I think I said never drink again to excess. I don't think I would ever, you know, say no. And besides which, you know, and this is where the reasoning really cut in. Christ's first miracle. Canaan, first miracle, turned water to wine. God wants us to drink. And besides which, it was free. So I don't know how you... That was kind of like a full house, as they say in Vegas. So we went over there, and they brought us just buckets of booze. That, not a good idea. The weatherman, the TV weatherman, Jim, was with me. Jim and I had a little thing we used to do. We'd drink, and I'd put his head through drywall. I don't know why that would happen, but, you know. And I'd pretend he was my dad. You know. I know I don't look like a violent person, but when I drink, I don't talk, and I fight. It's the craziest thing. You know, I would just look at you, and I just want to slap you across your face. And the happier you look, the more I wanted to slap you across your face. Because I knew that you were somehow taking something away from me being that bloody happy. Don't like it. The marketing manager of Labatt's came in and he said, you guys got to go. And I said, but you said we... And he said, I know, but you just swung from one end of the room to the other on our chandelier. Like, we don't... This is your... You guys are out of control. I said, well, who wants your damn beer anyway? We left. And we went to a Chinese restaurant called the Birdcage. And I tried to order some bird seed. And they didn't have any bird seed. And they were the... Like, what is with that? Why do we want to fight everybody and everything? That's why the book says we have to stop that. But once they finally got me calmed down and the bird seed thing was over, I ordered some Chinese food. Why is it that alcoholics need to lie? You know, I get overwhelmed with the need to lie. And I had an uncle, for example, a terrible raging alcoholic, Uncle Sam, who was a decorated Canadian warrior, had medals everywhere. He was in the Canadian infantry, one of the first people that liberated Holland or Italy or somewhere. And when Sam drank, he would go in detail about his time in the Navy. I said, Sam, you're in the Army. No, I was in the Navy. 145 pounds soaking wet, ask your mother. And then he, and he was in the Guns of Navarone. I mean, what the... Somebody once said to me when I was in my first 6 or 7 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, hey, saw you in Safeway the other day. I said, no, you didn't. I was in Safeway, but I didn't want him to know, and I don't know why. Just needed to lie. And so anyway, I lit these idiots in the Chinese restaurant, and I said to them, did you guys know that the ancient Chinese cooking method makes it possible to eat bones? None of them knew this. And apparently my back teeth, which I broke off that night, didn't know it either. But I did eat all the bones. And we had a lot more to drink, and we went from there, and then the physical stuff started, and we started, Jimmy and I used to push each other. I don't know why. Like, if there was somebody else around, we'd push them, but if there was just the two of us, you know, it wasn't sexual, it was just fun. And so we left the Chinese restaurant, we got in an elevator, there was a little guy in the elevator, we slammed him around for a little while, he I don't know what that is. It's just so funny. They look so scared, and you feel so powerful. It's just... And I think Jim looked happier, too, because it wasn't happening to him. And we got off that elevator and we got into this nightclub, and then I remembered that I was actually once an entertainer. And I got up. And Jim was a drummer, and it was about an hour, and then they wanted us to go home now. We went outside and we started pushing each other, and it's bitterly cold. Canadian winter, February, probably 30 below. You know, in Canada, when it's that cold and you spit, it goes ping, 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 ping. There's a great joke about a Texan sitting at a fire. He'd been up in Canada. Somebody said, "What's it like up in Canada?" He said, "Well, I'll show you." He reaches down to his pant leg and he brings out a little brown marble and he into the fire and it goes. So anyway, God, my sponsor's here. I am so dead. I'm telling you. I knew this was going to happen because I got over familiar at our table. They got me so relaxed, I feel like I'm visiting. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, Jim and I had another guy with us now named Murray, and we started pushing each other around, and Jim pushed me into a parking meter, and it really hurt. He drunk as I was, right between the shoulder blades. And so I thought, no. Airborne. So I grabbed Jimmy and like this, and he goes through a bank window. In slow motion. And I'm just thinking, damn! You know? Wow! And I turn around and there's a cop with a gun right in my face. And that's when I have a theory that there is only one brain that all alcoholics get to use periodically. The reason I think that is that if you ask any alcoholic at any point how many drinks they've had, it's always two. Right? And when you're in trouble, what do you always say? I said to the cop, you know, you are overreacting. I'm drunk. We're just having fun. We don't mean any harm. And then hit the car, you know, and Jim emerged out of the bank. Jim doesn't want to push anymore. He says, I'm so done with that. You know, we could just, as far as I'm concerned, Marts, we could go home right now. I had a good night. And the cop says to him, "Aren't you the weatherman?" He says, "Yeah." And it happened again. It happened to me all the time. I'd get caught speeding. They say, "Are you that guy on the radio?" I say, "You are so funny." And they'd let me go. They'd let me go and they'd let me go. So anyway, it ends up with the bank manager down there and some guy with some plywood, and they nailed it. 4 o'clock in the morning, Jim and I are heading for my car. And you would think it was over, wouldn't you? No, it's not over. It's not even close to over. I'm an alcoholic. It had occurred to me that the cop had delayed us long enough that I'd been now in the parking lot beyond the overnight fee. I said to Jimmy, "We're not paying to get out of that parking lot. That's $12. We're going over the top." Jim said, "Yes! Damn straight! Let's do it!" Murray, who was not as drunk as the two of us, was saying, I think this might be a bet. Shut up! We get in my car. Now, the Dukes of Hazzard was on TV. Do you remember that little? That's what I had in my mind. Now I know why they put those big cement blocks at the edge of the parking lots. Because when you wind your car up to 50 or 60, and you're coming across that parking lot, and you would think you would just lift over that block, that doesn't happen. Ow! Ooh, we hit the dashboard. It breaks. You're all the way across the dashboard. The radiator hits the ground. Like that. Murray's got blood out of his nose. And Jim says, "I think we should phone your wife to come and get us." which may explain why I'm currently divorced. Anyway. So. I want to advance now to, I'm 24. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was in university, there was a medical doctor, a guy named Michael Slobodian, brilliant diagnostician, great guy, just a wonderful man, big family man, 7 or 8 kids. And Michael, because I was in university, I was very nervous. I had a lot of nervous disorders, like when between drinking. Did you have those? You know you're an alcoholic when you got your tie around your neck, right? Have you done that one? Anyway, so Michael would, you know, he would treat me. And I think he thought I had VD, a Valium deficiency. And he would, after, and he was always nice to me. He's interested in me. You know, why are you so nervous? I'd say, oh, I don't know. Heights, I'm afraid of heights. Breathing, girls. And academically, I'm challenged, you know. So Michael, you know, he was such a great guy. And he'd take me in his office, and he'd open up what I called the tickle trunk. And then we'd get a bunch of, like, a popcorn sack of pills out of there, and then I'd leave. And I had, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, although I didn't take them, I had 2 pockets of plastic bags of Valium. Because I always thought I could go insane at any minute. I might need these because I've never been sober this long before. What if I flip at a meeting? I'll be fine, you know. How's your program going? Good! I'm driving a Cadillac, aren't I? You know. God, that hurts. I don't know why I keep doing that. I'm killing myself up here to entertain you people. I hope you're having fun. I always feel sorry for people that are having a really bad time when they get a speaker like this, and you're so funny. You know. Trust me, I know how you feel. I've hated every speaker I've ever watched, and at one time or another. I went to British Columbia. I was in a radio station there. I got in a lot of trouble drinking. I came home. I got through an amazing after-the-window thing. I woke up that morning, and I had bits and pieces of the day. You know, like, here's a tip for you. If you're in the room and you don't know if you're alcoholic, normal people don't black out. This is something reserved for us. Normal people go, barf, you know. That's alcohol abuse, watching them drink, isn't it? And, yeah. Can I get a different... This is warm. Really? Huh. Wouldn't slow it down. It was half urine for me, madam. I don't care. It's just... I need the... We drink largely for the effect of the... Anyway... My sister, that the morning I came to, and I was just in so much trouble, and God, you know, why do I do those things? Is that morning, the remorse, right? The horseman that Bill talks about, bewilderment and terror, and my wife, it was not good. Phone was ringing way off in the distance, and I went and picked it up, and it's my sister. That's who you need when you're sick and in trouble, right? Your nosy sister. And she said, opening remark, "Hi. Do you think you have a drinking problem?" I'm thinking, how does she come up with this crap? Nobody drinks better than me. I have no problem. I mean... People pass out, I'm still drinking. It's not a problem, right? And then she says, "I'd like you to talk to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous." I'm thinking, I haven't got enough trouble. Now I got to help some guy from Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the closest I ever came to Al-Anon. I'll tell you. You guys know I love Al-Anon, right? I wouldn't tease them if I didn't. So please don't get resentful at me. Anyway, I saw this guy, and he was amazing. He told me that if I drank anymore, that he would break every bone in my body. And I said, why? And he said, because when you drink, you're going to get hurt, and I don't want you hurt by strangers. I will hurt you myself. The kind of love we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, by the way, we're Alcoholics Anonymous because you don't know who we are, and we're everywhere. Okay? I got sober. I got sober because they dragged my body to 90 days of meetings, many meetings with those guys, and that same story every night. I was desperate. And I walked through those doors, and I'm now not desperate. In fact, I have $70 million, and it's wonderful. Really? Goody for you. Because I have a $500 payment that I don't know how I'm going to make, and you're old and really wrinkly, and I don't care what you say. So, I was 23 when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought these guys should just be taken out back and put down. I felt sorry for every single one of them. I'm serious. When you young guys look at me and think, oh, Jesus, am I going to look like that at 30 years? Not necessarily. You may look worse. I'm digging a deep hole here tonight, aren't I? This isn't going well. Anyway, so what happened was that I recovered in Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't recover from, you can't get cured from this thing, but what you recover from is the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body that is around you. I just thought, I can't stop, I can't start, I can't anything. Everything I do turns eventually to something bad. I mean, I just believed that I was a loser. And that's a hopeless state. And I thought, even if I stay sober, I'll be walking across the street, I'll get hit by a beer truck, you watch it. It's kind of, you know? And, but I, he just, he insisted that I went fishing, and then they would make fun of me. And sometimes they would throw me around like Jim and I used to do, but they were sober. And they used to take the seats out of their van, and then we'd put a newcomer in the back and go up and down the ditches until he admitted that there really was a God. It was kind of fun. But so, as you move up in the van and finally you're in a seat, it's very funny. But when you're back there, it's not so funny. They told me if I didn't learn how to have more fun sober than I did when I was drinking, then I was going to be drinking again. See, I mean, I got that. And you see, from the time Michael Slobogen, the medical doctor, had seen me as this quivering, quaking, high blood pressure, completely irrational kid, so the next time he saw me, I was sober. And it didn't occur to me to tell Michael anything had happened, you see. And so he comes in, he takes my blood pressure, like this, and he kind of looks at me. Excuse me, he says. And he leaves. And he comes back, he takes my blood pressure, and he does it all again. Excuse me, he says. And he comes back again, he says, are you the Marty Jeffrey that used to come here a couple of years ago? And I said, yes. He said, what the hell happened? So I keep checking your records. Did you have a body transplant? What happened? And I said, I quit drinking. He said, and that, you're this different? And I said, yeah, I guess so. And he said, wow. You come in my office. And I thought, oh, God, the tickle trunk. I'm already rehearsing how to say I don't need any of that stuff anymore. And Michael says, listen to me carefully. He said, I have a son. He's drinking all the time. Can you talk to him? I said, Michael, I'd be privileged. I would love. This is what we do. We carry the message to other alcoholics. He said, I don't need a lecture. Would you just talk to my... You know how you are when you're new?
Yeah.
You know that. I wish I was a drunk, but I'm just walking by the building. I don't, you know. Anyway, I said, Michael, anything for you, buddy. I'd be pleased to do it. And so I went home and I waited for the call. And at 7 o'clock, the call came. And he said, you don't have to bother. And I said, oh, he won't talk to me? And he said, no, he's dead. Yeah. And I said, what happened? He said, motorcycle, drunk. And that was like one of the first sober deaths. I've had several people die since I've been sober. All of them young, it seems. They always have, they think they got another drunk in them. You know what I'm saying? Young Vince Clark, you know, fell asleep drunk, threw up, drowned in his own vomit. Orris Hollick threw up in his, you know, car accident, suicide. It's just, it's horrible. And so that's what it was like. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the what happened part. You see, I have, this may surprise you, a mind that chatters a lot. And when it's not swearing, it's accusing me of things, you know? And if I ever get a break from that, then it starts sex stuff, you know? It's just, and then if we get a break, then it starts to talk about, you know, we're going to war with Iran, right? And they're going to need you in the services. So, you know, I'm not an American, not a problem. And so what I was doing all of my life was getting the mind to be quiet by doing animal-like things, just getting underneath the noise. And when I'm drunk, I don't kind of think like I just kind of, you know, hit you. That's it. That's all I'm thinking about. And what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous was that they said to me, you need to accept something about yourself. And it says in the first step that we admitted we were powerless. You know, powerless means that there would be something that has more power. That would be, this is revelation to some of you, a higher power. And somehow my mind went, oh, duh. You know? And it said that this higher power actually was interested in a creep like me. And that this higher power could restore me back to feeling normal and shut all the voices off in my head, at least turn them down. And I said, I'd like that. And I turned my life, everything that I was doing, and the things that I wanted to do over to Dwayne, the God of my understanding, my first sponsor. Yeah. I phoned him one time and I said, Dwayne, I can't believe in God. He said, why not? And I said, because if I ever turn my life over to God, you want me to be a missionary in probably in Africa. And Dwayne said, what would they do with an ass like you in Africa? And he said, you don't need a higher power. I am your higher power. So, but there's this huge, like, once you understand from watching, and this is how it happened. It is truly one alcoholic talking to another. You start to watch these people and the way they live and the way they breathe, and there's an ease about them. And they're fun. You know, I mean, they really, as much as I didn't want to laugh, I was really starting, I couldn't help it. When you got the new guy in the back and the van bounced, that's fun. That's. Or when the guy with the biggest ego at the meeting is giving, you know, his speech. And everybody's already practiced, and they give a signal, and you all stand up and start saying the Lord's Prayer. That's fun. Yeah. But I couldn't get any relief, because what I've learned from you in Alcoholics Anonymous is that the defects of character that I have block me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. I can't get any release because my release has to come from a higher power, another place. That my mind goes in the same circle and comes up with the same solution all the time. Let me tell you, the most dangerous thing in the world for an alcoholic is believing that something's true that isn't true. And if you're anchored into some thoughts and you think these things are true and you're basing your behavior on things that aren't true, you get a wrong answer a lot of the time. And so what they said was very rude. I would say, I think, and they would say, who cares? Shut up. And I know that they don't do that today because it's not correct. But you'd be looking at a dead person had they not have done this to me. I'm sorry. I was virtually kidnapped, never mind intervened. I was removed to a safe place called Dwayne's car. You know, when he was 40 years sober, I went and spoke at his convocation, whatever the heck, I was a bunch of, oh, we're so grateful to him. And I got up, and I was like the rest of them. He did this for me, and he did that, and he gave up his life. And when he got up to talk, he said, what a pile of crap. He said, I didn't care about you. I was fighting with my wife. I had nowhere else to go. So, if I can't get any relief and I've got these accusations and conversations and misappropriations going on in my head, how do I get well? Well, you see, this is what the program's all about. It's amazing, isn't it? They have this step where you kind of go through your life and you look at stuff and you say, okay, you've been doing this and 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 you're not getting anything happy out of it. Why do you keep doing it? I say, because sometimes I'm happy doing it. But you know, upon inspection and with another human being listening, I found out I was never happy doing it. I was just blocking myself off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The book says when people like me block themselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit, insanity returns. And when insanity returns, I drink. And when I drink, I die. And therefore, these types of thoughts and resentments, it says, have the power to kill. I can't afford a recreational resentment. The speaker you're going to hear tomorrow, Dick, he's the closest thing I've got to a sponsor. Now, this guy really sponsors people. And I'm pathetic. And I have no discipline. So even being a pigeon is difficult for me. I said to Dwayne one time, why do you call me a pigeon? He says, because when pigeons are sick, they squawk. And then when they're feeling better and flying high, they crap on you. That's why I call you a pig. You know why I like resentments? Gives me a sense of identity. I hate you. I must be somebody. Oh, yeah. I love my sad little story. You put me in a room alone, I can start crying over what's happened to me. That's why you need a sponsor. Because he said, you know, you need a little pain to go along with your crying. I went to Dick and I said, I don't want to talk in AA anymore. And he said, blessing for all of us. Anything else? That's not really true. What he said was, why don't you try and get some control and just do it not as frequently? And because even you might carry a message on an odd night. And then he said the most bizarre thing. He said, when are you going to apologize to your sister? I said, excuse me? Are you struck senile or something, Dick? My sister spent $100,000 of my money, and when she blew through that, she told the banker that she had access to my checking account and spent another $26,000. For what do I owe her an apology? When Dick's really upset, he goes like this. That's about it. They call that flipping out at his house. But anyway, I think he was pretty upset. He said, let me ask you a question. When you gave her the $100,000, did you know that she was lousy handling money, big shot? He said, you just gave her that money because you thought she'd go away. You didn't want to be bothered, and then she blew your money, and now you're mad at her. When are you going to phone her and apologize? Damn, I hate that kind of logic. Oh, true. And so Christmas I think it was Christmas Eve, I phoned my sister. Now, this is the girl that got me in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm resentful. I forgot all about the fact that she saved my life, and I wouldn't have $100,000 if it wasn't for her. That's a small matter compared to her, you know. You see, when I'm resentful at her, I can't get connected to this higher power, and my sobriety is going, I can't connect. You know what I'm talking about? You go to meetings, and people are going, they all look like that. And you look across, and somebody else goes, you go, what the hell are you? Here, you know. That was the biggest word in 1960 was the word ear. Ear. It's an oldie, but I got to. Yeah. I need to do this in smaller groups for a while. I can see that. Anyway, I love Dick. I respect his program. I respect him. I respect... Well, what he said was true on top of it. So I phoned her and I said, Lori, it's Marty. And she said, oh, what's up? I hadn't talked to her for 7 years. I said, I want to apologize for my behavior around that money. And for the next, I think, somewhere near 4 hours, she rehearsed all of my character defects. She told me that my father, who I had not spoken to for 2 years when he died, because I'm a recovered alcoholic. Yeah, I got mad at my dad because he wasn't paying enough attention to my children, because he was wasting his time with my sick mother. You know, I'm telling you, when you believe something is true, like I believed it was true, there's more important. My mother had Alzheimer's disease. She was dying. In my mind, spend some time with your grandkids. Give me a sense of identity. I'm better than you. I'm smarter than you. I'm younger than you. I always was better than you. If you wouldn't have got me with that one hit that night, I'd have nailed you. I'm telling you. You know what I'm saying? And so she just, it just went on and on. I'm thinking of Dick, and I think, what would he do in a situation like this? So I just, and finally she said at the end of this, just vomiting of anger, I love you. I have missed you terribly. And that was the end of it. We've never had a crossword since. We talk all the time. And that was like Christmas Eve, and the day after what in Canada is called Boxing Day, the day after Christmas, my mother died. And to know that I could go to that funeral and not have that resentment. I don't know, you know, some people say, hey, your mother was probably hanging around until you two idiots healed it up. I don't know. I don't know. But I do know that the minute that that stopped, that communication started again. And I started to want spiritual things again. When I'm talking about spiritual, anytime it's spiritual, it's when my ego, which is just this huge collection of thoughts and feelings that I have, ideas that you've told me about me, ideas that I've heard about me, and this thing, which is it's a great tool. Don't get me wrong. Everybody needs an ego. It's just that mine's like a power saw, like one of those self-charging power saws that got out of the stand, and it's just... It's like the water in New Orleans. Water, everybody needs water, but when it gets out of control, it's not a good thing. Or the fire in California. Any natural thing that gets out of control is not a good thing. And so I'm not suggesting I'm at war with my ego. I'm just saying I am not my ego. This collection of thoughts and these things that I believe to be true aren't necessarily true. And so what happens is that when I get into this position of turning the resentment and all of that frequency down, other information starts to come to me. I start to kind of go above the chatter. I start to get into a place where my thoughts are cohesive. And I'm able to sit still. You know, this is all right. I was really happy. I was golfing 36 holes a day. I don't have to work. I was just out there thinking, all right. And then one day my wife came down and she said, I don't want to be married to you anymore. And I thought, damn, where's Dick when you need him? you know, the thing that I learned from all of this, and it, what is so wonderful, I did go to Dick, and I said, this has happened, and he said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I got this wonderful opportunity to go and work with children's cartoons in Washington, D.C., of all places. And he said, go do the best possible job you can ever do. You know, be there, be present, be in your own life. Yeah, incredible advice. Been there 2 years, and as you heard tonight, I met this incredible younger woman. In fact, my daughter, when she saw her picture, said, my God, Dad, she's beautiful. What grade is she in? I said, darling, you're making a case for why animals eat their young. You know, it's like, today, at Caesar's Palace, in the front lobby, I don't know why I'm telling you this, but I want to, at the fountain, I got down on my knee, and I asked her to marry me. Yeah. Yeah, she said yes. And the thing that I didn't know, because I was so nervous, was that everybody in the restaurant was watching me do it. And so when I, you know, got up, I turned around, everybody's going, you know, wow, what a rush. And then I put $100 in a penny slot on the way out. And God blessed our union with a $1,000 jackpot. It was just, it's true. Anyway, yeah. That's really nice to tell people of gambling disorders. Anyway. Oh, man. Yes. Yeah, I know. A physical demonstration of how actually recovered I am. You know, there was a, I'm going to close here pretty quick, but here's the bottom line. There was a drunk, probably 10 years ago anyway, a guy named Joe the Wino. Do you remember him? Joe used to talk about the fact that he'd run into a physicist, and the guy told him, there is no such thing as cold. There's only the absence of heat. You know, I checked that out. It's true. There is no duality. Everything is just a lack of something. What's really interesting is that when you're not putting really crappy stuff into your life, nothing bad seems to really happen all the time. I mean, yeah, life goes on. But what's really interesting is that it's not so much that I'm doing all these wonderful things in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's that I'm not doing all those really counterproductive things that I used to do. I'm not sitting in my head all the time analyzing, you know, you and what you said, and then, you know, that guy didn't say hi to me and, you know, to you. And I would love to stand here. I mean, the lying is just about right to hear it, because I want to say, and I'm good in the car now, too. So, push it too far. God is still working on that defect. But you see, the 12 promises are really interesting things. I have a terrible fear that one of these days Budweiser is going to get a hold of these things. Can you imagine them having a beer commercial with claims like this? You'll be amazed before you're halfway through. You will know a new freedom and a new happiness. You will not wish to shut the door on the past, and no matter how far down the scale you've gone, you'll see how your experience can benefit others. No, but when I look at that, all of the action words in the 12 promises are really weird choices for words. Like, for example, it says in there that the defects are what? Lifted out of me. That's been my experience. I can't honestly tell you I worked on anything and I don't have that anymore. It seems like if I work on it, I seem to give it more power. The crazy thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, big surprise, upside down and backwards program, only program in the world is as soon as you know what you're doing in your job, they rotate you, right? They say, there are no dues or fees, and pass the basket. What the hell? Anyway, it should be no surprise to me that I win through surrender. It's the paradox in Alcoholics Anonymous. But what do I mean by surrender? It doesn't mean that I am not trying anymore. It means that I become, and this is huge, willing. Willing to have these things removed. You see, in the working steps when I'm finding out what I'm thinking, what I'm revisiting, where I'm stuck, that sucks. Because people like me immediately want to say, how am I going to fix all of these problems I'm having? I hate to hunker down and do this business. You know, I need to get this program. Yeah, give me a beer and I'll think about it, you know. I ain't fixed anything yet. I didn't ask Dick to stick his nose into my problem with my sister. I have no earthly idea why that man decided that day in that cafe to say that thing to moi, but he did, and it changed my whole life. See what I'm saying? I was willing to go to any lengths to have this madness taken from me. I don't want this chattering going on in my head all the time. I don't want to be unhappy. I want to be free. I want this stuff lifted out of me. And so when you go through all of this sort of like reporting of what's wrong with you and the inventory stuff, you get to the step where the real work's done, it's just like one paragraph in the big book. Step 6, step 7, humbly ask him to lift these things out of me. Just as soon as they become willing, it's a non-issue. It's just the becoming willing that's a little tough. Why do we hang on to some of the things? And I'm just going to close here real soon, so there's no point in you people leaving one at a time. Probably from another program, you know what I'm saying? And I was just going to drop the truth. That's fine. That's good. When I get all that stuff in a line and then I say that I become willing to have these things taken away from me, inevitably what happens, and if I really mean that, I come, and the book talks about this. It says that we have a spiritual awakening. In other words, you can't have an awakening unless something was sleeping, right? And so spiritually, I'm not there. I've got my you know, that going all the time. You know, ego, 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 you know, fear, fear. And what happens when the spiritual piece takes over is that it just says to the ego, shut up. Calm down, you little buzzsaw. And then I seek through. Now remember, you people that have had like dual addictions, it's prayer and meditation, not prayer and medication. To improve our conscious, the awakened contact with a God that we have come to terms with, a power greater than ourselves. And so I hope that might be of some service to you. It's really helped me a great deal. I mean, whenever what I do now is when I start that stuff, when that you know, listing goes on in my head and bang, I'm mad at somebody or something, I just say stop. Stop for a minute. And I just say to myself, calm down. What would God have you do in a situation like this? And it's just, it is amazing how many situations. I mean, the business I'm in is very, very difficult. I've had more than one coworker, colleague, friend say, how do you stay so calm? And how do you function the way you function? It's this program, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the ability to understand that I'm not the deal. I don't have to figure it out. That if I just stay quiet long enough, and I just kind of like become a wimp, that God will give me an incredible answer, and then I get all the credit for it. That's the part of it. You know, he doesn't need any credit. He can build a flower. Doesn't need it. I want to close with something that I now believe with all my heart and soul to be true. It's an old poem. And I believe that when we become willing, that there's some people that just show up. And this guy wrote this poem a long time ago. It's called The Auctioneer. And he was talking about the master's hand. What I find with the coffee I was at this morning, I was with Billy and some other people, Lenny from Oregon and so on. These guys don't have to say a whole bunch, and they can just touch me. Inside, I just get better for being there. And so it goes like this. It was battered and scarred, but the auctioneer thought it was hardly worth his while to sell that old violin, but he held it up with a smile, and he said, "Good evening, friends. Who's going to start the bidding for me?" And somebody said, $1. $1, he said. And who'd make that two? $2. Who'd make it three? $3? $3 once? Twice? Going and going, but no. A gray-haired man from the back of the room came and picked up that bow, and he dusted off that old violin, and he lovingly tightened the strings, and the music he played is like the sound that's made when a chorus of angels might sing. Well, when he was done, the auctioneer, but now in a voice soft and low, said, "Now what am I offered for this violin?" And he held it up with the bow. $1,000. $1,000, he said. Who'd make that two? $2,000? $2,000. Who'd make it three? $3,000 once. $3,000 twice. Going and gone, said he. Well, some in the crowd laughed out loud, but others could not quite understand. What a change to value. And quick came the reply. It was just the touch of the master's hand. And you know, many a man with his life out of tune, battered and scarred by sin, is auctioned for cheap by a thoughtless crowd, just like that violin. A bottle of beer, a mess of pottage, a game, and he stumbles on. He's going once, going twice, going and almost gone when the master appears. And we don't quite understand the good that's been wrought or the soul that's been got with one touch of a master's hand. Thank you for letting me share. Bye-bye.